I tell you what, things would be a lot better today if the bastards hadn't kicked me out. The master. Not on top form. The first Conservative administration of the post-EU era had proclaimed itself a national government, on the basis that a handful of Eurosceptic Labour MPs had crossed the floor to support it, as did the 8 UKIP members. But the euphoria of victory had carried it for only a few months before exhaustion set in. Political theatre is like actual theatre. It exposes frailties and it accelerates fate. Rivalries which in civilian life might have taken 80 years to fully emerge gape in politics after a few months. Small flaws of character which in the life of a dentist or a gardener might be merely irritating eccentricities will tear a cabinet minister to pieces in less than a year. And so it had happened to the Conservatives' national government. Relatively decent people had been transmuted into gurning gargoyles and grotesque puppets and set against one another until the stage was mottled and sticky with blood. There was no brave new world. In parliamentary politics, there never is. How, meanwhile, had the country fared? Formerly, Britain had been a divided, frenetic little archipelago buzzing away thanks to high levels of immigration and the fickle favours of international capital. Freed to be herself, she began to fall back. Immigration almost ceased. The unions reasserted their power. The right-wing agenda proved less popular in practice than it had seemed during the election campaign. The abolition of comprehensive schools and the introduction of fees for hospitals had seemed like clarion calls in the manifesto. The reality in the streets of many cities was disgruntled and confused. Scotland's socialist upsurge became unstoppable. A few of the city institutions that had threatened to leave the country in the event of Britain's departure from the EU and relocate their headquarters to Paris and Frankfurt had carried out their threat. Things hadn't been quite as catastrophic as the Europhiles had predicted, but house prices in London and the South East tumbled. Bankers, having been the villains of previous decades, were rather missed once so many of them had gone, or rather, their free spending was missed by the smaller businesses that had depended upon it. Britain's proudly independent treasury, no longer having to pay vast subventions to Brussels, found that the numbers still didn't add up. 3 cabinet ministers were filmed frolicking happily on a bed by the 7-year-old daughter of one of them. The footage was posted on Facebook and went viral. In other words, politics continued too much as usual. It was in these circumstances that Alwyn Grimaldi rose to become leader of the Labour opposition. He'd been a fixture on the political boar's circuits for years, a regular speaker at Fabian conferences, always present at political book launches, a reviewer of newspapers on television programmes. His dandified clothing, Mediterranean colouring and exotic name led many people to write him off. But he was not only phenomenally well organised and a reasonably sharp performer in the House, he had fashioned what the commentators call a narrative. What this meant was that he spoke well and clearly about the mortal battle going on between global corporate power, mostly still centred in America but increasingly in China as well, and the power of old-fashioned elected democracies. Only politics, he argued, could redress the unfairness and evils of the relentlessly inventive and ever-young energy of capitalism. "We are the civilizers," he said, "and we live in a country that still badly needs civilizing." He had, in short, a story. He sounded like a latter-day Karl Marx, shorn of the simplistic political extremism that had caused so much mayhem during the 20th century. The fact that he'd worked in corporate PR helped. Other Labour figures were more handsome or prettier. They had more sensible names. They had better-cut suits. Like him, they had turned their backs on the master and the legacy of New Labour. but somehow none of them matched the edgy, mildly paranoid mood of the time as well as did Elwin Grimaldi. Meanwhile, one small pebble at a time, the government's authority slipped away. A jolly genial law officer who'd thought he'd be promoted to Home Secretary discovered the hard way that he wouldn't be. Behind his florid Falstaffian mask, he was a lean and angry man. Rather than accepting his demotion, he attacked the Prime Minister in highly personal terms and resigned his seat. The Conservatives threw everything at the by-election and lost it. Under pressure, the PM mustered a cross-party majority to suspend David Cameron's 5-year Parliament rule. One stone. Then the PM's old enemies in the 1922 committee put it about that he'd become depressed and there would have to be a leadership challenge. Foolishly, he denounced the anonymous voices as fruitcakes and no-hopers, only to discover that a well-spoken and well-regarded female committee chairman was prepared to appear on the Today programme and announce that she would take him on. Two stones. Still, no further landslide would have taken place had it not been for an entirely random accident on the slopes of Val d'Isère. The chief whip, pursuing a son skiing too fast down a black run, lost control, hit a pine tree, and was killed. The Prime Minister lost his closest political friend and the only man who had a grip on the party. That by-election, too, was lost, this time to Elwin Grimaldi's Labour Party. None of the commentators had expected this, so they were cross. As a result, all of them, led by Peter Quint, who had been mocking Grimaldi as Labour's worst leader since Michael Foot, promptly reversed their positions and found glints of greatness in him. Tory backbenchers, not knowing what to think, because no one was now telling them, grew uneasy. The party was at this time in bad-tempered coalition with the remaining rump of the UK Independence Party, which, despite having lost its raison d'etre after Britain's withdrawal from the EU, struggled on in a mood of bloody-minded euphoria. Its fundamental position was that the Tory party wasn't grumpy enough. Certainly its own MPs, a colourful collection of chain-smoking, shouty people, seemed furious about absolutely everything, all of the time. One morning, in a spasm of pure fury after reading a Daily Mail diary item about his exuberant bow tie, its leader, Roger de Coverley, announced that he was withdrawing support from the coalition forthwith. In politics, forthwith is a satisfying word. Forthwith. The rumble of individual stones quickly became a deafening avalanche, and the Prime Minister, bowing to what seemed inevitable, went to the King and asked permission to dissolve the House of Commons for a general election. The King, who'd never much liked him in the first place, cheerfully agreed, even though there was no obvious reason for an election. If there's one thing the British people hate, it's an unnecessary general election. It gets in the way of the television schedules and greatly increases the number of irritating people knocking on your door. But the die was cast. In Barker, Caroline Phillips had Leonard Lomax's majority of several thousand to defend. The constituency wasn't entirely safe. It had gone Tory during the Thatcher years, and UKIP's Paul Lambert was still haunting the countryside. Curra, therefore, fought like a tiger. She rose at 5 and didn't return to her room at the Travel Lodge until after midnight. She drank no alcohol, lived on coffee and fruit, and spoke herself hoarse. She had to begin to shake constituents' hands with her left hand because of the bruising on her right one. She was, at least, known. Her sexuality and her beauty had ensured that she was one of the new candidates who was featured in the national media websites. Perhaps in the circles around Elwin Grimaldi, word had already gone out that she was favoured by the master. At any rate, neither the leader of the Labour Party nor any prominent shadow cabinet figures ever came to Barker to support her during the campaign. Nor did the master himself. but his wife came, and a cluster of once famous New Labour figures, and dozens of bright young things from London whose work in obscure political consultancies apparently allowed them the time and freedom to help Barker choose its new Member of Parliament. Their old-fashioned canvassing, street by street, house by house, revealed that Carrow's early lead was narrowing. The Muslim areas of the constituency were divided between radicals who supported the newly formed Islamic British Front and those who remained loyal to the Labour Party. Luckily, the latter tended to be older and more likely actually to vote. Carrow's Conservative opponent was a lean, elderly and supercilious grandee called James A. James, who had served as a minister under David Cameron. He had lost two constituencies so far, which only increased his bottomless contempt for the British electorate. But his rasping voice and eye for an opponent's weak spots made him dangerous. He pecked away at Caroline, portraying her as a cynical, wealthy metropolitan blow-in who knew nothing about either Barker or the real world of profit and loss. The young girl, he called her. When they met face to face for debates in the constituency, he seemed completely impervious to her charm. Caro, who'd never experienced rejection like it, found herself spooked. Then a fortnight into the campaign, a Scottish journalist called Tony Moretti turned up. He said he was there to discuss a story about some skullduggery or other in the local council, but when they met, he urgently suggested that she ask James A. James whether he had ever visited a certain address in Cricklewood. The next evening, in front of a large audience at a local school, she did. The air seemed to go out of him. He had been two Jameses before. Now he was barely a Jim. He didn't even turn up at the count to observe Carrow winning the seat with an increased majority of 10,000. And when it was all over, she got a personal call of congratulations from the new Prime Minister-elect, Ulwin Grimaldi. In Glaiket, David Petrie had a far easier ride. The Scottish Nationalists had bafflingly chosen a former Tory, a baker called Fisher Donaldson, to fight him. On Murdoch White's instructions, Davies said nothing about the Forlaw case or Lord Auchinleck. The master, after consulting with his wife, had decided to pass the information about the sex ring cover-up to Ulwin Grimaldi, as it would have the maximum political impact coming from the party leader. And so it proved. It knocked the stuffing out of the Conservatives, and it also put Grimaldi, warily and uneasily, in the master's debt. Had Tony Moretti and his comrades at the Scottish Socialist Newsletter known that all their hard work would result in a substantial boost for the master, whom they despised from the soles of their boots to the tops of their skulls, they would probably have done away with themselves. David Petrie had no need to get in on that act. Compared to the struggle for the nomination, the election itself was almost an anticlimax. And so, on Friday the 21st of September 2018, the Earl of Dimbleby, chairing the BBC's election coverage, was able to announce that the barely known Ulwin Grimaldi was the country's new Prime Minister. "It is customary on these occasions," said Lord Dimbleby with the merest hint of a sardonic smile, "to describe the result as historic and to suggest that nothing will ever be the same. But I rather think we've gone beyond that, haven't we?" And he winked. At his recently bought country house on the South Downs, the master held what he called a kitchen supper, though a more accurate description would have been council of war. Sadie, sober now for more than a year, was an immaculate hostess, far more amusing than she had ever been in the old days of power. Leslie Kahn, Margaret Miller, Murdoch White, all the old warriors were there. "Well, everybody," the master said, "stage one is complete. The Tories are out. We do have the tiny, tiny little problem of that fool Grimaldi, but our people are in place. Enough of them to give us a real chance when the time comes. We have some spectacularly talented and driven new MPs. Now, as we all know, it's our job to make sure they don't put a foot wrong, that they climb the ladder so fast it's almost impossible to concentrate on their rise. So, keep them close. Make them your friends. If they give you any kind of trouble, bring them to me. There was a delicious scent of shepherd's pie, and a couple of bottles of decent burgundy had been opened, but the master led his guests outside before eating. To general bemusement, a stocky farmer was waiting for them with no fewer than 4 shotguns under one vast arm. "I've taken up clay pigeons, everyone," said the master with boyish glee. "You must all have a go. It's the most relaxing thing. I find it helps me to think." Only the former Home Secretary, Margaret Miller, and Murdoch White accepted a weapon. Leslie Kahn was laughing. "Oh, dear me! Oh, dear, dear, dear me! Oh, dearie, dearie me! This must never get out. Imagine the papers. Imagine the cartoons. Master, dearest, this is just too funny for words." Murdoch disagreed.
"It's not funny. It's not funny at all. It's bloody dangerous. What are the rest of us going to say the next time some half-wit jumps up and says, 'Ooh, he's just a Tory'?"
"Tories shoot birds," said the master. "I just shoot imaginary enemies. Paul!" Like a little pink plate, the clay disc soared across the horizon. The master failed to bring it down with his first barrel, but shattered it with his second.